Welcome to Week 8 of Computer Science E52, or CS50. Today we're going to be talking about some web design stuff, transitioning out of C, talking about tools like HTML, PHP, as well as some additional programs, such additional functionality on the terminal, including Chmod, and also focusing on using database software such as MySQL in order to develop dynamic websites and get you prepared for working on problem set 7. So let's start out by talking about what exactly HTML is. So HTML is basically the simplest tool you have at your disposal for creating any type of web page. So the simplest web pages that we used to see back in like the mid-90s when the web was first getting big, you might remember things like on GeoCities, the really basic web pages. You'd have like the header with the title, like, welcome to my web page, like, sign my guest book, like, this is my web ring. And you'd have just the plain hypertext, hyperlinks to other pages. You'd have the animated GIFs of like babies dancing or hamsters dancing, like we saw in lecture recently. And that's all really simple design that can be implemented in HTML. So what exactly are we talking about when we say HTML? So obviously, hypertext markup language. So hypertext, but hyper, essentially. So text with some functionality. Text that is in some ways interactive. For example, you can click on some of the text that is made to be a hyperlink, and that'll take you to another page. Or perhaps you can fill in some form or click a button that'll do something. So just enhanced text. And markup language, meaning this is some language we're using to format this text in a particular way, such that when the web browser renders it on the client's computer, they're able to see the web page as you intended it to be displayed. So for example, you can arrange your data in tables so everything appears in nicely ordered rows and columns, or you can place horizontal rules so you have your content broken up into pieces, which are easier to read. This is sort of like when you think about when you format text in something like Microsoft Word, or even a simpler program like WordPad, or something like something akin to that in other operating systems other than Windows, where if you highlight some text and you want to make it bold, you might just hit Control-B, or you click on the B button up in your toolbar. So web pages are not richly formatted in that sense. They're not stored in files that store this rich formatting information. They're just sent from the server to the client's computer and rendered by the web browser. And what's sent between the two is just plain text. So it's just a text file. So you can't really have bold text in just a .txt file. If you look at something like a text file you open up in your text editor like Nano, you don't really see any rich formatting. That doesn't exist there. It's just characters, just these ASCII values. So we need to come up with some way to describe the content of that document using a markup language so that the web browser knows what to format and in what way. So how do we do this exactly? HTML uses tags, which include regions of the page. Each beginning tag has an ending tag, so you have content placed within these opening and closing tags. So these tags might be like HTML or body or something else that you may have seen before in lecture. And these tags may also have attributes, which describe additional properties of the content placed within those tags in addition to the properties which are associated just with the name of the tag or the functionality which is implicit to the tag. So what does this look like exactly? Let's take a look at an example HTML page. So if we pull up just this first example, we have a basic HTML page. You see at the top here, I've included what I also include here, an HTML comment. If you want to place a comment within your HTML, and you should do this, particularly as your web pages start to get longer, just so that you yourself can find different sections of your page that you want to edit more quickly, you can simply place a comment within an angle bracket followed by an exclamation point and two dashes, and then ending with two dashes and a right angle bracket. So this is sort of like a comment tag, you can think of it being, where you can place any text within here that'll remind you what you're doing at this particular point in time in your file, but it'll not be rendered by the browser and the user will never see it, unless they open up the source for the web page, in which case they will see it. So I guess don't say anything mean to your users in your comments. At the top, just place another comment in the same style that I normally wouldn't see. So really, you can think of these comments as being much like the comments you'd use in C. Here we have a special doc type tag. For our purposes in this course, you just have to remember to place left angle bracket, exclamation point doc type, and then HTML, then right angle bracket. This specifies that we're using the HTML5 standard, which is what we have been using in lecture up to this point. If you want to get fancy and use XHTML, which is actually now being, in most places, deprecated in favor of HTML5, which is the newest standard. If you do prefer XHTML for whatever reason, if you have prior experience with that, do note that your doc type will have to be different if you are not adhering to the HTML5 standards. But if you don't know what I'm talking about, don't worry about it. Just do what I'm saying and what you've seen in lecture, and I assure you, you'll be fine. Now we get to the substantive aspect of our document. We enclose any HTML markup within our HTML files with these HTML tags. So you'll note that first we have this HTML tag, this opening HTML tag that just brackets and then HTML contained within. And then we end it with this bracket followed by slash HTML and then a closing bracket. So this slash is indicating this is a closing tag or an end tag. So anytime you open up a tag, you need to close it as well later in the document. Anything between those is considered to be HTML, so it makes up the substantive bulk of our HTML file that's considered by the browser. Within this, we also have a head tag, which also you'll see has a closing tag. Enclosed within that, we have a title, which is apparently "Want to Learn HTML." So that is the title of our web page. So if you open up this web page in Google Chrome or some other browser, Mozilla Firefox, Internet Explorer, Safari, anything like that, that's what would normally appear in the top bar of your web browser. Or if you're using a modern browser, actually more likely the title of the tab in which the web page is being displayed, that's what appears there. You can think of the head as being the header information for the web page. In the same way that in PSET 5 we consider the header information of a file, such as a bitmap file, we can store header information, which is sort of like meta information about the page, within the head of a document. A common example of this is the title, but there are other things we can place there as well, which we'll see later on when we're discussing more advanced aspects of HTML. Below the head, we have the body. This is the body of the web page. This is what is contained within the actual region in your window which displays the web page itself. So up here you might have the title contained within the tab, but in that rectangle that displays the actual web page, everything that's there is contained within the body itself. And if I look here, all that's contained in this body is the string "this text goes in the body of the HTML document." So if we were to open up a web browser now, and I'll open up a new one, and we were to open up, let's see. So since I've placed this on the cloud in my public HTML folder, I can go to cloud.cs50.net/my username/, I've also placed this within a folder called section for my convenience, and then /html1.html, which is the name of the file, and hit enter. Oh, I can actually see this web page, which I was just working on in a text editor in the cloud, immediately appear on the internet at this address. And you'll see that this just contains within the body, this text goes in the body of the HTML document. And if you look near the top, actually, right where I said it would be, is the phrase, "Want to learn HTML?" which is, if you'll recall, enclosed within the title tag of the head of my HTML document. So you'll see where exactly that goes. Okay, so this is all relatively simple stuff in terms of what we can do in HTML. Let's get a little more advanced and take a look at an example with a little more going on in it. Okay, so now we're adding attributes and a couple of different types of tags. So we have here the introduction of a div tag, and div just stands for division. So this is just denoting some region of the page. Div by itself doesn't really do anything except specify that region by enclosing it. But if you add these attributes, which you can think of sort of as being parameters for that particular region of the page, you can set different properties such that the content is going to be formatted in a different way. So what do you anticipate will happen if I set a line equal to center for this division of the page? Yeah, so what's going to happen is the text that is contained there is going to be centered. So previously everything was left aligned rather neatly to the left of the page. In this way, much in the same way we would if we clicked on the center align button in Microsoft Word, the text will actually be centered in the middle of the page, which is very useful for web pages where you might have a title near the top or some image you want to display prominently in the center. We also have this other tag, which doesn't really look like the tags we've considered previously, which is left angle bracket br slash right angle bracket. So there's a slash at the end of that tag, and there also doesn't seem to be a second corresponding tag denoting some region. So why might this be? What's happening differently for this tag? Yeah, so this is a break tag. So what that means is we're introducing a line break. So much in the same way that a backslash n character in a C string would cause the computer to skip to the next line and begin printing characters there, this tells the web browser that it should now move to the next line and start placing content on the next line in the web page. And if you think about how that works, well, you can't really think of a line break as specifying a region of the page which contains content. So it seems like if you were going to have two tags, they'd have to be right next to each other. But that seems a little excessive. Why have these two tags next to each other just to maintain the convention that we have an opening and a closing tag for everything? It's sort of like we're inserting an object at this point that just takes the form of some tag. So what we do when we have tags like that, which sort of stand on their own, is instead of having two tags, which might look something like this, we combine them. And so we place this forward slash at the end to simply indicate that this tag stands by itself and that there's no corresponding closing tag. And this creates a line break here. What about this next tag? What do we expect that this is doing? So in a way, it's a link. But it's not like a hyperlink where it's some text that you click on and then it takes you to another page. It's referencing some source, which is an image file. And what's actually happening is that an image is being inlined into the page. So this is how we place an image on a web page using HTML. So we use this image tag, img, and then specify the source attribute to equal some value. And this value is the location at which some image file is currently located on the system. So then, title, so hilarious secondary punchline. So what does this title attribute do? Those who are fans of XKCD might be given a clue. Okay, so you might have noticed that certain images on the web, if you highlight them with your mouse cursor, bring up an additional window that contains some text, usually some description of the image. Recently, some webcomic authors have taken to using this space to include a second punchline for their comics, just like an added joke. XKCD is quite noticeable for this, as Dinosaur Comics, for example. So, wasn't it obvious? Eggs, is what you said? Of course. And then alt was something I inserted earlier. I may have fixed this example, I'm not sure I remember too, but alt is generally used as an attribute which displays in some browsers in place of an image if it fails to load. This should actually be gone. That might fix this now, actually. Let's see if this actually renders this time. Okay. All right, so I actually made my own little XKCD comic for you for the purposes of this demo. So we'll see here that the division of the text that we created previously is in fact centered. So only that is centered, not the image as well, only the things that were contained within that division of the page, which allows us to specify style in a way for only a particular region and format other parts differently. We now have this image, which is a little comic I drew up for you. I hope you enjoy it. And if we highlight it with our cursor, we do in fact get a hilarious secondary punchline pop up on our screen. By setting the attribute in the image tag, we were able to implement that, and we get a little extra functionality. So just some examples of... Thank you, Chris. So just examples of some of the simple things we can do with HTML to give us some of the functionality that we're used to seeing in modern web pages, albeit in some sort of humble format. Okay, so... any questions about the basic HTML tools that we've seen so far? Yeah?
So we code is pretty much like the same format as C, anything that's part of something we tab in.
Oh, yeah, that's a really good question. So in terms of formatting within an HTML document, the question was, do we have to format it using indentation much like we would in C? And let's see, I pull up the correct window. Okay, if we were to take a look at how I had these documents formatted, I typically indent with two spaces. So you'll note that we have a tendency of containing groups of tags within other groups of tags. Generally, you want to close the tag you opened most recently first. So you'll notice that title is closed before head is closed, because title is contained within head. So we have this convention that we indent by a couple of spaces when we're containing things within other things. Two spaces is just sort of a useful convention. It doesn't have to be that way. It should be consistent. If you wanted to use four spaces, much like you may have been accustomed to using for C, that's fine. But do note that when you're writing in HTML, you'll end up having much deeper levels of nesting than you typically would in C. At least in most cases you will. In this case, obviously, it's not so bad. But do be warned that if you choose a larger amount of spacing, you may run into trouble later on. I would personally recommend two. Do make sure you are being consistent, though, because we will, of course, be looking at style in terms of HTML as well, because without this indentation, the web page does become very difficult to read and difficult to maintain. On that note, actually, for our purposes, we do value readability by a human, but if you think about it, since that white space actually doesn't do anything, it's sort of interesting to note that if you were to include that in some enterprise website, something that you get many hits on, including that website, that white space might actually be wasteful, because then you're spending a lot of bandwidth just sending those blank bytes, those white space characters that have no functionality. So if you actually ever get curious about how a particular web page is implemented, you can just, in Google Chrome, it's Control U. On most other browsers, you can right click and go to View Page Source. But if we take a look at this, just as an example of something complex, much beyond anything we'll be worrying about implementing in this class, you'll note that Google, since they do have a very complicated website, elects to remove all the white space before they place their page online so that they don't have to pay the extra money to transmit all those white space characters across the connection. So this clearly illustrates that those white space characters don't actually change the functionality in any way, but since we do concern ourselves with style and readability, and you'll note that this is impossible to read for any reasonable human being, that is something that you'll want to make sure you spend time maintaining. Okay. Any other questions about HTML so far? Okay. Oh, and yeah, the typical format is just generally tag, attribute equals some value for that tag, and then you place stuff within it. And it's honestly as simple as that. Once you get used to the most common tags, you find that writing documents in HTML is actually really easy. Okay, so you'll notice that I was able to just edit these files contained within some folder within my file structure that in my directory that I have in the cloud, and all of a sudden I was able to access them on the internet. So that should actually trigger some alarm bells in your head, because if you can just access files that are contained on the cloud on the internet, then you don't really have all that much privacy. And it's true that only those files which are contained within the public HTML directory are accessible. It's still something you might want to be a little concerned about, because what if you're using some file in your web page to generate content on the web, on your web page, such as a PHP file, but you don't necessarily want other people to be able to see what you're doing there and look up all the secrets you have that you're using to generate your content on your website that maybe you're making a lot of money off of. And just in general, you want a way to control the content that users are able to see within your directory structure. It's not something you want to just leave wide open. So the tool we have to restrict permissions on the content you can contain in your web directories is called chmod. And you use it right from the command line as you would use something like GDB or Valgrind. And you're able to pass a particular numerical argument to chmod followed by a file. And depending on the numerical argument you pass to chmod, that adjusts the permissions for that file in such a way that you can restrict how others are able to access that file and what they're able to do with it. So, yeah, just to recap, it's used to restrict access to files as well as directories which are accessible via the internet that you store in your account. And the permissions are assigned by setting three octal values, which correspond to permissions for read, write, or execute. So what do I mean when I say an octal value? Yeah, it's a base 8 value. So that means that it can vary anywhere from 0 to 7. We talked about hexadecimal values previously, which varied from 0 to 15, so base 16. Octal numbers are just base 8. so they can vary anywhere from 0 to 7. So we use three octal numbers, and they correspond to permissions for read, write, or execute for three different groups: user, group, and world. Okay, so how does that look exactly? Well, you'll note that we're using octal values, and we have three different types of permissions which we want to change for each of the three groups of users. Okay, so what happens is we end up actually setting a bit string which has 9 bits. And these 9 bits can be arranged into three groups. Does anyone know what these three groups correspond to? User, group, and world, actually. I forget what I put on the slide sometimes. And then what about these three bits which are contained within each of these substrings? Yeah, exactly. So then we have read, write, and execute contained within each of these. So if each of these is set to 0, then that means neither the user, the group, nor anyone in the world can do anything with this file. They're not able to read, write, or execute it. And if we set this bit string in such a way that all of these are set to 1, then anyone can do anything. So it's fortunate for us that we can set everything to 1 for the user, and then to 0 for everyone else, for example, if we like, so that we can do anything we want with the file and no one else can touch it. And maybe we don't want to be able to write to the file because we don't want to change it, because we want to make sure we're not accidentally affecting it. So we could set it up like this too. So we're able to impose restrictions on ourselves as well, just for safety considerations. So suppose I did something like chmod 644 to some file. How would I set up these values? So the 6 affects the user. So what sequence of ones and zeros do I want here?
110.
Yeah, 110, the binary representation of 6. So we represent this octal value here using 3 bits. You'll recall from hexadecimal that we can represent any hexadecimal digit using 4 bits or a nibble. We can represent any octal value from 0 to 7 in 3 bits. So each of these 3 bits represents one of those three numbers I referred to previously. So if we set to 644, one of these three octal values. So this is set to 6. How would we set this and this to 4 each?
0, 0.
Close. That'd be 2.
100.
So then we have this bit string arranged such that it's 110, 100, 100. Or 6 for the user, 4 for the group, 4 for the world. And if we take a look on the terminal, we can actually see this happening. So if I look in this directory and type ls-l, setting that -l flag, I can actually see this bit string for each of these files. You'll note an additional space here for a d, which just signifies that this is a directory. You don't have to worry about that. It has nothing to do with what you're chmodding. So we'll notice that this directory has been set to 7, 1, 1, which you'll typically want to set all your directories to if you want them to be accessible by the user. You'll notice that a PHP file, which we'll get into later how that works, we don't want the user or the group to actually be able to execute that at all, or read it or write it. We don't want to give them the opportunity to see anything that's contained within that PHP file. And we at least want to be able to read and write it. So we set this up as 6, 0, 0. And regular HTML files, we set up as 6, 4, 4. And just to demonstrate how to do this on the command line, if I wanted to suddenly give everyone all sorts of permissions on HTML1.html, I would write chmod 777 HTML1.html, 7 being the largest octal digit. And then you'll note that HTML1.html now has everything open to everybody. So that file is completely accessible to anyone, and anyone can do whatever they want with it on the system. Generally, we won't want that. So if I set this back to chmod 644, everything's back to normal. So simply write chmod, and then the three octal values you want to set for user, group, and world, and then the name of the file or the directory, and it'll set the permissions accordingly. Yes? Okay, good question. So what constitutes a group? So the user is you. So in this case, it'd just be Chartier or some other user that logs into the cloud. The group, in this case, for me, would be staff. For any student, it would be the student's group. And maybe for David, it would be heads or instructor or something like that. So the group is some class of users that is not open to everybody, but is open to a subset of everybody. So user accounts can be placed in groups within the structure of the system we're using. So that's not all that useful for you, but good to know about. Yes?
If you don't chmod, is there a default that it automatically takes?
Let's see. Emacs, some file.txt. I believe the default on the cloud is either 64, I think it's 644. Let's find out. Oh, it seems to be 600, actually. So typically, files will default to 600 on the cloud. That's system dependent. So it'll vary depending on what server you're using or if you're using doing this on your own computer. But on the cloud, it'll default to 600. It's a good question. Any other questions about chmod or file permissions? OK. Cool. Let's jump back into the PowerPoint. I have a lot of windows open today. Oops, not yet. Okay. All right, so now forms. So this is something slightly more advanced, which we can do on web pages. Everyone's used forms before in web pages, which have been implemented using HTML. If you've ever opened up a Google spreadsheet or pretty much created an account on any website ever, you've had those text fields, which you can click on and then enter a string into, which denotes like maybe your username. And then you have some other field where you type in a password and those little asterisks show up so someone behind you can't steal your identity. You have those larger text boxes you can type messages in. You have radio buttons, which are just buttons such that if you select one and then switch to another, the other one becomes undone, and you can only choose a maximum of one of them. And then you have check boxes, which are essentially just these Boolean boxes that you can set to either true by clicking them and checking them, or false by unchecking them. And then there's submit buttons as well, which sends all this information off somewhere. So essentially, all those inputs together constitute a form on a web page. And we'll take a look at an example of how you can implement a form and what it looks like. So if I take a look at this particular example, a web page I made last year called Blinky Text. And for those not familiar, at Harvard we have blocking groups and linking groups, which determine what people were likely to live with after freshman year in the house system. And we have so people in your blocking group technically you typically refer to as your blockmates, people in linking group linkmates, and a portmanteau of that might be blinkmates, which gives us Blinky Text, a tool which I created, which allows me to send SMS messages or text messages through the internet to any of my blinkmates here, or my blinkies, as it were. So the way this is implemented, we see that we have an HTML form. So we start off with something I actually forgot to mention, but which should be familiar to you, a drop box, which lets anyone within the group select their name. And then we have a text area input field, which allows me to type some message. Sorry, just another CS demo for section. I did this yesterday too. Everyone's going to get a message. And then a password field where I'll type in my secret password. A checkbox, I can determine whether I want a message confirming everything was sent. And then I can click the submit button and send this. It sends it to another page, and I'm taken to that page, which gives me some feedback telling me that all these people did just receive yet another annoying message from me, from section. And then I can just take myself back here. So we'll see here, we're able to input information from the user on the page, and then using the form submission button, send this information from this page to another web page, which then uses that information in some way, which we'll talk about, to do something interesting. So how do we implement this exactly? What does all of this look like in HTML? So if you take a look at my other, I need to reconnect. One moment. Okay, and we're back. So if I open, okay. So see here, we just have all sorts of HTML code going on. Let's skip down to the form. Okay. So let's see here. We began a form with this form tag, which has some particularly interesting attributes, action and method. So action specifies where this information is being sent to. You'll recall that when we clicked on the submit button, we were whisked away to another page, which displayed the names of everyone who had had a text message sent to them. That page, which we're taken to, and which this information is sent to, is specified by the action attribute of the form. So in this case, it's some page called sendtext.php, which denotes a web page which we wrote using PHP in addition to HTML, which we'll talk about next, or later in the section at least. Method specifies how this information was passed to the other page. So what might I have used? I seem to be using post here. What might I have used other than post? Does anyone know the other option?
Get.
Yeah. So I can either use post or I can use get. What's the difference? Yeah. So when you use get, the information you're sending actually appears in the URL. And if we use Google as an example again, actually, if I were to type some search query, if you look up here at the top in the address bar, you'll notice that there are a bunch of arguments which are separated by ampersands and are defined within the address. So this is information which has been sent to this Google page via get. So all that information being sent is actually stored in the address bar or in the URL and displayed in the address bar to the user. Why don't I want to use get? I mean, it's very simple. Services like Google use it for some things, so it can't be all that bad. Why is it bad for this form? Why do I want to use post, which doesn't display things in the address bar? It keeps it hidden away in the HTTP packet, where users can't see it as easily, at least. Yeah, so there's a password here, and I don't just want to place my password in the address bar. That sort of defeats the purpose of having these asterisks here that obscure what my password actually is. So technically, my implementation isn't much more secure than this because the password is still being sent in plain text in an HTTP packet, which anyone using something like HTTP live headers and monitoring the traffic coming out of my computer, since it's not secure in this case, it's not encrypted. You'll recall the FireSheet demo from lecture, actually, as an example of how this can be dangerous, can still see that password contained within the HTTP header and read it themselves. But considering the nature of this web page, that's not such a problem. But if you were to launch a website which depends on keeping people's accounts secure, and that's actually important to you, you want to make sure you take that into account and take additional measures. But in this case, we're satisfied with just keeping things in the HTTP packet and not displayed in the address bar as prominently. Okay, so moving forward, we're now using a table, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's some table containing rows and then cells in each of those rows, much in the same way that you might create a table in Microsoft Excel or in Word or PowerPoint, actually. You define a certain number of rows and columns. So here we just make it piece by piece. So we start out with TR. I have some line breaks above, but that's not significant to the table. They just happen to be placed there. TR, which opens up a new table row. So anything between this TR opening tag and the TR ending tag, which is farther down the page, is contained in the same row. TD opens up a new cell, and ending TD closes that cell, allowing us to begin a new one after that. So here we just have name placed in the left cell, and then in the right cell, we're placing a select tag, which defines that we have some drop-down menu, which just happens to be called select, which contains options, which have as attributes values, which are the values which are sent to the other page if that option is selected. And select name dot dot dot, that's what actually appears in the drop-down menu. So we're able to define what value to send to the other page and what value is being displayed to the user for them to select so they can be independent. It's not obvious here, since we have not looked at PHP just yet, but I'm doing something which is actually pulling more information to the page. Don't worry about that just yet. But if I had hard-coded all the names into this page, I could have written something like option value equals Matt, and then Matt is the name which would be selected, and then option. And then the name Matt would also appear in the drop-down menu. I'm doing something else that makes this unnecessary and which implements the same functionality, but that's what this would look like. And also note that the value and the actual name that's seen by the user upon which they click doesn't have to be the same. if I wanted to map the number 1 to Matt, so the other page, when it sees 1, knows the user selected Matt, I can do that as well. It's just one maps to the other and represents it. Okay. Don't worry about this just yet. We'll talk about PHP shortly, and you'll come to have an understanding of what we're doing between these purple brackets. But for now, move on to more aspects of the form. So we have here another row where we have place this text area tag, which has an ID and a name, two additional attributes to help us identify the information that's being sent to the other form. Some JavaScript stuff, which you don't need to worry about just yet. And so we end the text area. So we have this input field, which is just one of those input rows we can type the name in, but it's larger. You'll know if we looked at the page again. We have this one message field that is larger. We're able to define how big exactly it is. In this case, it's more convenient to have that larger field because we expect larger input from the user. So there's some flexibility there in how we define what our inputs look like to give better functionality for the end user. We also have some very simple inputs, which are literally just in input tags, and their type is specified by a type attribute. Text is just that one line text box which you can type like a username into. Type equals password means that it's a password field. So essentially what happens here is it's just like a text field, except everything is displayed as asterisks so that you don't compromise the integrity of your password if someone happens to meet nearby. That does not imply encryption. It just means that it won't be displayed on the screen. It'll just show those asterisk characters. Another type of input is a checkbox, which you can default to being true or false by setting a value attribute. Checked equals check. And the type is defined as checkbox, a few other attributes that are able to be set. And finally, one of the most important types of input for any form, type equals submit, the submit button, where the value is whatever text is placed on the button. So you'll note that I wrote send on the button. That's not by any means default. You can specify it to say submit, which is generally what people tend to do, or any other string that you'd like. And what happens when you press the submit button is the information is sent to the page which you specified previously, setting the attribute, the action attribute in your original form tag, which you'll see that we are actually closing here. And then the browser will move to the next page and do with that information whatever is specified within that page. Okay, so that's a lot of information. This isn't something you're expected to memorize. I'm just giving you an overview of the different functionality we have available in HTML for forms. This is definitely stuff you can all look up, and in fact, if I were to implement a drop-down menu right now, I'd probably have to look up the exact syntax used for it, so don't worry too much about being bogged down by everything there. Just have an idea of what different tools are available to you here and the vague way in which you would go about implementing them. Any questions about what we just saw? Okay, great. Let's move ahead to talking about some more advanced techniques for formatting text on the page. So we have a tool available to us called CSS, which stands for Cascading Style Sheets. And a style sheet is an external document which specifies formatting for different parts of the page in a very concise way, which allows us to apply the same type of formatting to various sections in our page, which we can specify within our HTML document, so that we can save ourselves the trouble of having to go through each part of the HTML document and specifying, okay, I want this table and this table and this table all to be formatted in the same way, so I have to set the attributes for each of those three tables to be this. We can actually take that out and place it in the CSS file and just specify that each of those three follow the rules specified for maybe tables of type 1 in the CSS file. So much in the same way that we can encapsulate code using a function in C, we can sort of encapsulate this formatting information in a CSS file when we're designing a web page, which allows us to concisely express the type of formatting we want and also very easily adjust any of this formatting such that it spreads throughout the entire page, or cascades, as if you will, to the rest of your content. So, and this can also be inlined if you just want to make small changes using style attributes. We'll talk about how to do that. Essentially, the way that this looks, well, let's first actually take a look at the, well, okay, we'll just do a brief overview of this. So style attributes allow for formatting of tag contents using CSS terminology, CSS declarations. And these look like things like this. So like align, colon, center, font size, colon, small, color, colon, blue, display, colon, block. So some attribute followed by a colon, followed by the value which is taking on. So for any tag you're using, you can write something like div style equals center or align, colon, center. And you can also just make this even simpler by writing div align equals center and just taking one of these out and making it an attribute on its own. It can be a little cleaner if you if you're including many of these to put them all in one style attribute so it's all bundled together. But note that this is analogous to writing display equals block similarly somewhere else within the tag without even including that style attribute. But there's just two ways to do it. I show you this formatting because this is what you'll use when you're using an external style sheet. And that'll look something like this. It's some file which is separate from your web page, which ends with a .css extension. And the format is something like this. You have the name of a selector, which is the name of some type of tag. It could be body, it could be HTML, or it could be something else. And then contained within these curly braces are declarations followed by semicolons that look just like these. So if you wanted to specify that within every H2 tag, which is a header tag, which defines making text some particular size, like a header on a section of a web page, you could say, okay, anything contained within this header would be, for example, was made to have small font, which is centered and blue. And that would specify for that anywhere you have an H2 tag, you apply that formatting. Okay, so in the abstract, this sounds like it might be useful. But let's see how useful that actually can be. So if we take a look at Blinky Text here, this is actually a pretty boring, straight-laced website. You wouldn't really expect Blinky Text to be doing anything like all that exciting on a Saturday night, I guess. It's just kind of plain. Like, it's got these really straight stand-up letters. It's a little boring. But what you don't know is that every night at around 9 o'clock, Blinky Text lets its hair down. So since we won't be here till 9, I'm going to invert this condition. And don't worry about what I'm doing here because we'll talk about it more when I talk about PHP next. If I invert this condition such that after dark is true between 5 and 9 rather than between 9 and 5, what happens here is this causes a different style sheet to be applied. So we're applying different CSS code to this page essentially. And let's see what that does to the formatting of our web page. Whoa. So that just changed significantly. So the bulk of the markup language which makes up this web page is actually exactly the same as what it was previously. But because we're able to apply this formatting throughout this page using just this external style sheet, we're able to make a drastic change in the appearance of this previously very boring website just by changing one single character, actually, in the code. So what is that style sheet that we're using look like, and where is it? So, and don't worry about what echo means just yet. We'll talk about that in just a couple minutes. But what's essentially happening is when this is true, so during a particular time of the day, when we generate this web page and give it to the user, we're including this tag, which is contained within the header section of the web page, which is called link. And we give it an address, which is the address of the style sheet, attribute rel equals style sheet, saying it is in fact a style sheet. The type is text, CSS, and media equals all. Don't need to memorize that either. You can certainly look it up in any examples or somewhere online to learn how to link in an external style sheet. So what's that look like? So if we go there, okay, so we have each of these input.special, text area dot special, body. So this looks like what we saw before. Body and then contained with the curly braces are CSS declarations, which look just as I described them. So background color colon black, make the background black. Color colon some hexadecimal value. That should seem very familiar from PSET 5. So you can not only use these pre-existing terms which refer to specific colors, you can also just specify your own color using hexadecimal values, which gives you a lot of flexibility. You can set the font family. Apparently, I chose Calibri when I wrote this a while ago. You'll notice some of these also have something contained after a dot, after the selector, that's referred to as a field. So if I want to affect some text areas, but not all text areas in the document, I can add a field, which specifies that only text areas of class special are affected by this formatting. So the way you set that is just by adding a class attribute to your text area, which looks something like this. If I go to my text area, you'll notice that class is set to special. So that specifies that any CSS which applies to text area of having the field special is applied here. Oops. Yeah, and so essentially each of these declarations applies to those specifically. One note that we didn't cover previously, an A tag, an anchor tag, as it were, which typically looks something like A, and then one of the attributes is href, and then followed by some web address, and then you close that, and then it's some tag. I'll just write that. It would typically look something like this. It just hasn't appeared in any of these demos. Actually, it does appear in this one somewhere. It's near the beginning. Oh, it looks like this. So this is just a hyperlink, which is one of the things you're most used to seeing on the web. It looks something like this. It's actually called an anchor tag. So A, href, where you want to link to, and then the text for your hyperlink. So you're probably used to seeing these as being blue if you haven't clicked on them, and then they change to being purple if you've clicked on them previously. And you can actually specify how you want these colors to change by changing the CSS information for a link and a visited. So you'll note that I didn't want the color to change at all. I wanted it to stay the same color no matter whether you clicked it before or not, because it's not relevant. So I was able to specify that here by changing a:link and a:visited. Okay. Any questions about working with CSS or what we've seen so far using CSS? All right, so seeing none, let's go ahead and move toward the last subject of the day, which is PHP. So what is PHP? Well, PHP actually stands for PHP Hypertext Preprocessor, and PHP stands for PHP Hypertext Preprocessor. It's a recursive acronym, much like GNU, which is, if you're not familiar, GNU is not Unix, and GNU is, yeah. So it's cute. So when a PHP, so you can write a PHP file, instead of writing an HTML file to generate a web page. If you use Facebook, you've probably noticed that when you go to Facebook's homepage, you might see an address like facebook.com/index.php. And if you're just starting with HTML, you might scratch your head and wonder, well, why is this a PHP file? I thought all web pages are written in this markup language called HTML, and they have this HTML extension. So what's a PHP file? So when a PHP file is accessed, it's actually interpreted by the system and used to dynamically generate a web page, which is then produced and given as output to the browser. So you're not actually seeing the contents of the PHP page. You're seeing the output of the PHP file after it's been interpreted, after it's been run by the PHP interpreter on their system. And any PHP code contained within a PHP file is enclosed in these question mark tags. So let's talk a little bit more about what PHP is as a language, because it is a programming language, but it's not a programming language in the sense that we're really used to talking about, because it seems like it works a lot differently from C, because we don't compile it. It's sort of just interpreted and then used to output this web page. That doesn't really sound like programming. That sounds like, you know, making a web page. You know, writing something in HTML isn't really programming, and so PHP doesn't seem far removed from that. Well, PHP is a programming language. It's just not the same type that we're used to looking at, seeing as we have experience with C. So C is a compiled language, whereas PHP is interpreted. So what does that mean exactly? Well, C is compiled because we run it through a compiler before we ever run the program. We can't do anything with the source code until it's been compiled. That's not true with PHP. For PHP, the source code is actually interpreted. So you type out the source for the PHP, and then when it comes time to run that, even though you've never compiled it, you didn't pre-process it such that you're providing some executable file which is reduced to machine instructions to the computer. It's run through a PHP interpreter, which at the time of execution interprets each of those lines of source code and then does something accordingly. So this is much like how Java works. If you've used Java, it's interpreted through the Java virtual machine. Or if you've written anything in Python or heard about Python, Python programs also are not compiled. C is also strongly typed, whereas PHP is loosely typed. So what does that mean? Well, it's true that PHP will tend to yell at you less for errors, and the idea that it's a little more forgiving or lenient is definitely on the right track. So what it essentially means is that what type refers to is actually the type of the variables we're using. It's not like typing. It's like data types. So for example, whereas in C, if we wanted to declare some variable that contains an integer, we might write something like int x equals 7. And then if we want to change that to something else, we would write something like x equals 9. But we'd always make this an integer. We would never write something like x equals banana, because that just doesn't make sense, because what we've created is an integer, and a banana is not an integer in any way. So PHP, we don't have those sort of restrictions, and we don't even have to declare our variables before we initialize them to something. I could implement very similar behavior to what I've just described in PHP by writing something like $x. We always start our variables with dollar signs by convention in PHP, without exception. Equals 7. Okay, and this is fine. Even though I've never used x before, I'm using x now, and the interpreter knows that I'm creating a variable called x because I'm using this. And if I want to change it to 9, all right, $x equals 9, and all right, I just change that value to 9. And if I decide halfway through my program, you know what, I don't really want to put an integer in x anymore. I'm bored of integers. And I want to make x contain banana. Well, that's okay too, because PHP is loosely typed. It's not strongly typed. We don't hold these variables to their data types that they start out with. We can assign them to contain anything, and we can use them anytime we want without ever declaring them initially. So this might seem really nice after working with C and being frustrated by complaints thrown out by the compiler, but just as C gives you enough rope to hang yourself with in terms of memory allocation, so does PHP give you enough rope to hang yourself with in terms of your variable names. This is one of the reasons we are so strict about trying to maintain good convention in naming your variables. Like, don't use names like these that I'm using right now in section, like x, to contain some value. Use something that's more descriptive, because then if you accidentally reuse it, well, in C it's going to yell at you. In PHP it's not. It's just going to overwrite your previous values, and then all of a sudden one day when you're trying to add 7 to some other number, you end up adding banana and nothing makes sense, and you can't find your bug because what could possibly be causing me to add banana? So this is something to keep in mind. It's one of the greater strengths of using a language like PHP, since you don't have to worry so much about declaring all your variables at the right place and making sure you're using different variable names, but it can also come back to bite you in a big way. So let's take a look at some PHP code, which I use to implement blinky text, to give us more of an idea of how we can use this. So this is a PHP file, but it looks a lot like an HTML file. Except you'll note that there's these tags which start with a question mark and end with a question mark and contain something that looks vaguely like C code. The syntax is very similar, if not identical to C. So what's happening here exactly? So a PHP file is written much like you'd write an HTML file, except that we have these extra tags here that actually contain executable code. So as the interpreter is going through this file, it's outputting all of the regular plain text as it gets to it. But then when it gets to these PHP commands, it executes them from top down. So the flow of control is much like C. So we output all of this beginning information to the HTML file. So that's committed to the HTML file. Then we get here and it's like, oh, all right, we have some code we have to execute. So let's go through this. We set hour to date, which takes parameter h. This is some program which is available in PHP, some function which we have available to us already, called date. By providing the h parameter, I get the hour, so I get whatever hour we're currently in. So seeing as it is about 8:36 right now, this would return 20. So it returns anything between 0 and 23. So then I run this command here, which normally I don't have this bang here, which sets this Boolean value it's Boolean just because I say it is. It could be anything, actually. I could assign that to 9 or monkey or 7.358, whatever I want. This is set to the evaluated condition hour greater than or equal to 21 or hour less than or equal to 5. So if it's late at night, this is going to be true, or after dark, I guess, else it is not. And then if after dark is true, then we echo, which is to say we print out the file, print out this file here, this string, which is an HTML tag. So this is included in the HTML file. If and only if, it is after dark. Else, it is not. So you'll see here that I'm linking in an external CSS sheet only if it is at the hour of the day that I'd like to do that. Then we proceed as we would in any HTML file since we're no longer contained within a PHP code. Here I'm including a particular image, or set of images actually, which are positioned relative to each other using CSS. If it's late at night, else I'm printing some boring title.png image, which is what you see during the day, just that blue blinky text font. Then if I move farther down, that may be it. Oh, and here, this is actually kind of interesting and ties into what we'll be talking about next. I seem to be doing something with making a connection using MySQL, which is allowing me to pull information back into this page into something special. That about does it for this file. So any questions on how exactly I'm using PHP or what it's doing in this file? So just to recap, essentially you write up a PHP file much in the same way you write HTML, but you can include this code here, which is very similar to C code, although it's more flexibly written since this is loosely typed, which allows you to define what exactly is included within your HTML file programmatically, or within the contents of the web page which is patched. I shouldn't say HTML file because this is not an HTML file. It's a PHP file. So essentially, you can have branching conditions in your page which define what you end up actually passing to the user. And this is interesting because if you didn't have this ability, then you'd only be able to pass static web pages to the user. And you would never be able to give them something different depending on some other values that you already have available to you. So anything that dynamically changed in the web page would have to be done on the client side using something like JavaScript rather than happening on the server side and then affecting what you're actually passing the user. And just coming back to the idea of file permissions, we'll note that, once again, any PHP file is set up such that we can read and write it, but no one else can do anything with it. The reason that's true is because we never actually let the user access this PHP file. The user can never see that source code that's contained with our PHP. We usually don't want a user to see our source unless we're part of an open source project. So what happens actually is that when the PHP file is accessed by the user, when they type that in the address bar, the PHP interpreter on the cloud in this case runs that PHP file and then passes the output back to the user as a web page which is displayed by their browser. So the user can never actually see that PHP code, and if I go to a PHP page, in fact, by just going to sendtext.php directly, this will probably give me a bug since I'm not passing anything in. So this is just an error. But if I look at by hitting Control-U, I note that I only see what was output by the PHP file, which is actually not properly formatted HTML in this case, but I don't see any of the code that was executed to get me here. So anything you write in your source code is actually safe because it's not going to be seen by the user, which is good because if you include, for example, your database password in your PHP file without obfuscating it by including it in a different file, then the user won't be able to see it and they can't get access to your private information. Okay. Any questions about PHP? Okay, so now we're going to talk about MySQL, which is software which we use with MySQL databases. So SQL stands for Structured Query Language, and it's a type of database. So database software, it allows us to store a collection of data as entries, and each of those entries contains a distinct set of fields which contain values. So you can not only define these like salient entries which are contained within your database, but also individual fields for each entry. So say each maybe each entry represents like a student in a class, And then you can modify specific information about each student, like their name, their year, their concentration, various other things. A database is arranged such that a database is your whole collection of everything. And then within each database, you have tables, which contain like one type of information. And each of those tables contains rows, so each different entry contained within your database table. And each of those rows contains a different field, which is a different property or parameter of that particular entry. So a database is like all the information you might have about Harvard, for example. A table could be information about CS50 students. An entry could be a particular CS50 student, or CSIE 52 student, I should say. And then a field might be their name, their concentration, their year, their social security number, et cetera. So how do we interact with a database? So we primarily use these four commands, at least in terms of what we're doing in this class. So insert allows you to insert a new entry into the MySQL database. Delete removes an existing entry. Select is going to allow you to select one or more entries based on certain criteria, so defining rows which have their fields having certain values. So maybe select all entries from the database table where name equals Matt, so I can find all the people named Matt in the class. And I can also update the fields of an existing entry. So say I'm keeping a bunch of entries which relate to students' grades on quizzes or something, and I realize I made a mistake in grading, and really this person deserved an A on the quiz instead of a B. I can update the grade on the quiz to an A for a particular student without removing the entry and then inserting a new entry. I can just update that one field. So if I have entries where they have 200 fields, obviously that's more efficient. So, okay. How exactly, what was that? What? Oh, there was a request to please do that and update everyone's entries. Sorry, I don't actually have access to said databases. Let's see. So if I actually go to cloud.cs50.net/phpmyadmin, hopefully it won't prompt me for a password. Yes, it will, which means that to do this demo, I am actually going to have to one second. Okay. You can't see my database password. Shit. One second. Okay. We'll edit this out. I just unplugged because I can't show everyone my database password on the screen.
Which Pokemon character is it?
Charmander! Okay. And we're back. Okay. So now that I'm logged into phpMyAdmin, I can access any particular database. So if I go to section, okay, so I can create a new table within my database called students, which just contains one field. Just for simplicity here, we'll just have a name, varchar, and go. Okay. Oh, and save, actually. Not number. What? Oh, length. So the length of the value. So we're just creating a database table now that's going to contain one type of field for each entry. That field's going to be name. It's a varchar, which means it's just a string, so a variable length char array, essentially. So if I go to chart your section now, this is my database. It contains a table called students. There's nothing currently in there. So if I pull up this this interface, I can actually run SQL queries directly on the database. Now, obviously, this isn't the way you're going to want to do it on your website typically. You're going to want to use PHP to send these queries directly to the database. But for simplicity in section, just to show how these queries are formed and also to avoid giving away too much for the problem set, we'll just do it in this environment for now. So, sorry guys. So, for example, let's try this first type of command. So, insert into table I just created was called students. So, insert into students value. Let's say I have some student named Robert. And then I hit go. So, insert into students value Robert. So, if I look at my students table now, you'll see that I do have an entry in this table where the name is Robert. Okay, so suppose Robert decides he doesn't like CS all that much, so he decides to drop the course. So delete from students where, so I'm specifying a type of row now, depending on the value in the field. So I'm deleting a student where name equals Robert. Do I really want to do this? Yes, I do. And now you'll see that if I go back to the row, back to the table rather, the row that was previously marked Robert is now gone. Okay, so suppose I go back quickly, insert into students value, just very quickly, what, Steph. Oops, cancel. And then we'll add Kristen. So now we have two students in the table. Okay, so we're able to get those again. And if I go back and use a select command, which we also talked about, I can just write select star from students. Select all, so that's select all from students. The star refers to just anything from students. And if I want to select, be more selective, I can write something like where name equals Kristen, for example, and this would return me just one entry. But if I'm not selective, we'll note that I actually get a resource which contains multiple entries. So what I get back is these two rows. So you can think of this sort of being a resource that has an array of rows, and each of those rows is actually an array containing various entries. So you'll find that when you're doing pset 7, suppose you wanted to select all the transactions that some user has previously done that you're storing in a database, you'll get a whole set of information which you can then iterate through and do something with each of the individual rows which are given to you in some particular order. So thinking about that resource in terms of having access to this particular subset of the table, in this case it's all the table but could just be some subset, is useful in thinking about how to implement that functionality in the problem set. Okay, so something important to think about whenever you're using MySQL or any database software, really, is it's always important to escape the contents of any string that's being passed by the user, which is included in a database query. So database queries typically look like this. So if you wanted to insert some student into your table, you're going to use some PHP command to send this plain text string to your database, wherever it lives. So any of these commands I was typing into this SQL window previously are actually going to be sent by your PHP program, essentially, to the database on some server. And this information is going to look like this. It's going to look like insert into students, the name of your table, some value, and then this you just leave a placeholder that says whatever the user gave me. So maybe that's some variable like $userString or $query or $studentName or something like that. And that's placed there. So, you know, this seems fine. The user types in a name of a student, it gets placed there, and then that is passed to the database, and it's this command is executed as it's sent to the database. So what could possibly go wrong? This seems great. So the problem with this is I'm allowing a user to directly modify in any way they please a subset of the, or a substring of what is essentially arbitrary code that is being executed by my database. So if there's any way at all for a user to place something malicious in here that causes the functionality to change, then I'm leaving myself vulnerable. And this might sound vaguely familiar to some people as nerdy as myself if they read XKCD, so go ahead and see if you can figure out what the problem with our implementation is. So the problem with little Bobby Tables is that his name happens to be formatted in a malicious way. So when some secretary at the school, not really knowing what they're doing, just doing some data entry, puts in the name of young Mr. Robert, single quote, parentheses, semicolon, drop table, student, semicolon, dash, dash, what's happening is that this command is having that phrase inserted in here, and you'll notice his name ends with a so his name includes this single parentheses preceded by a single quote and then semicolon, and after that is another SQL command. So what's happening is that this command which we're writing is prematurely ended and then followed by the contents of another SQL command. So we're essentially now sending two SQL commands to our database, and the second one, unfortunately, is formatted in such a way that it drops the table, which is to say it deletes the entire table from our database, and what happens is you lose an entire year's worth of student records. So just to go the extra step and prove this to you, let's do exactly this. Let's execute this exploit on our database. So if I can do this from memory, hopefully. Insert into students value Robert, little Bobby table's full name would be drop table students. I believe that's it, right? There's also that dash dash. That's actually not necessary for us to type in. But yeah, good memory. So let's if I can get this window back. Where was I? Okay. Drop table students. If we go now. And you'll note now that no tables are found in our database. So there are special functions in PHP that you want to run on any input which is passed from the user that you're going to include in a string which is being sent as a query to your database. It's something like a MSQL query, MySQL query escape or escape string or something like that. So make sure that you're using that on any plain text input which is taken from the user being passed to your database, or else you will get ganked just like this and you will lose correctness points because it will be incorrect. So that's just something to look out for, and hopefully this example will help you remember to do exactly that. All right, so that's all the content we have to cover this week. Are there any questions before we wrap up? All right, well, good luck on the problem set, and we'll see you back here next week. Thank you.